Welcome to this season of Future Makers Brain and Mental Health. I'm Professor Belinda Lennox. I'm a psychiatrist and a researcher here in Oxford. And this season, you'll be joining me as we demystify the science behind the most complex object in the known universe, our brains, and look at the wide-reaching impacts of mental illness on individuals and society. I'll be introducing you to some of Oxford's best academic minds working to solve the greatest challenges in brain and mental health. And I'll also be speaking to guests from beyond the university to bring their perspectives and lived experience and get a sense of the impact of what we're doing. Join us as we discover how Oxford is shaping the future of brain and mental health research. Welcome to this episode of Future Makers, where we're going to be discussing mental health in crisis contexts, covering both conflict and natural disasters. And I'm really lucky to be joined by an expert panel of guests to discuss this really important issue. So let me firstly introduce you to everyone that's here, and perhaps each guest can describe briefly their role and cover their current areas of focus around mental health in crisis situations. So first of all, we have Ben Perks. He's head of campaigns and advocacy at UNICEF. Welcome, Ben.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you today. I oversee global advocacy across a whole range of issues related to child protection, survival and development, and have a passionate interest in child mental health.
And then next we have Sabine Rakatamolala, who is Technical Officer for the Violence Prevention Unit at the World Health Organization. Welcome, Sabine.
Thank you very much, Belinda, and thank you for having me on this episode. So my name is Sabine Rakatamolala, and I work actually only since 3 years at the World Health Organization in the Violence Prevention Unit. Before that, I've worked with an NGO called Terre des Hommes, with UNICEF, with the Global Partnership to End Violence. And really, since 22 years, I've been working on mental health and the prevention of violence against children.
Thank you. And then we have three colleagues of mine from the University of Oxford. So firstly, we have Dr. Jamie Lackman, who's Senior Research and Teaching Fellow in the Department of Social Policy and Intervention.
Hi, Belinda. It's a pleasure to be with you and colleagues today in this discussion. I've been focusing my research on the development, the optimization, evaluation, and scale-up of innovative parenting support interventions in the global south, and particularly in areas of crisis, really with the aim to support child well-being and prevent violence against children. And looking forward to this conversation.
Thank you. And we have Dr. Isang Awa, who is head of advocacy, also in the Department of Social Policy and Intervention.
Thank you so much, Belinda. And I'm really delighted to be here. Like you've just said, I'm head of advocacy at the Global Parenting Initiative. And in the past few years, I have been involved in the different humanitarian responses that the Parenting for Lifelong Health team has launched. And I'm really interested in providing mental health and psychosocial support for families.
And last but definitely not least, we have Stephanie Eaglin-Pesch, who is a DPhil student and research manager in the Department of Social Policy and Intervention. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you so much, Belinda. It's a pleasure to be here. So my name is Stephanie Eaglin-Pesch, and as mentioned, I'm a doctoral student and research manager in the Department of Social Intervention and Policy Evaluation. I have a background in psychology, and my doctoral work now focuses on mental health and parenting practices of refugee and migrant caregivers. So at the moment, I'm working on developing a parenting intervention with and for families from Myanmar who are living along the Thailand-Myanmar border.
And it'd be great to discuss that more with you as we go through. But to start off with, I mean, Ben, maybe you could start by just telling us, why is it so important to support the mental health of families in crisis situations?
It's important, Belinda, to support the mental health of all children everywhere at all times. And we know for children that the biggest preventable cause of poor mental health throughout the whole life cycle is when people don't live as children feeling safe and loved and free from adverse childhood experiences. The risk for adverse childhood experiences is particularly high in conflicts or emergency situations. There are additional stresses on parents, on situations where children are separated from families, where children are directly under fire, and all of the secondary attachments they have in the community and school can also be affected by things like attacks on schools, shelling, natural disasters. So what's really important in those situations is to focus on ensuring that parents and communities know how to protect children, how to make them feel safe and loved, so the immediate effect of the emergency doesn't have a lasting traumatic effect on the child. And I just want to evoke an image that many people would know who have seen the film Life is Beautiful with Roberto Benigni, where a child and a father are sent to a concentration camp, and the father does everything they can to protect the child from the trauma of that situation. And as long as parents can be supported, protected, empowered to protect their children, we're doing the best we can to prevent crisis having a lasting traumatic impact on kids.
Yeah, I mean, it's just sort of self-evident how vitally important it is. I don't know, is it possible either Ben or maybe Sabine just to describe what kind of responses actually do happen on the ground when you get one of these disasters? What work do you do to support families and mental health of children? Sabine?
Thank you, Belinda. I will... Building on what Ben says, a small anecdote. I'm a child psychologist as well. And the first 10 years of my career, I worked as a child psychologist for an NGO, going straight to the field when there was an earthquake or a sudden outbreak of a conflict. And so Haiti earthquake and Pakistan earthquake and Peru, and then conflicts in Central African Republic and Mozambique. And I often found that the children that were in fact most affected were those that were already struggling way before the conflict at home. And we know from statistics today that 1 out of 2 children suffers from violence, either physical, sexual, emotional, or neglect. So those are huge figures. And so when you supersede that with a conflict or a natural disaster, of course, the situation gets so much worse. But it's important to remember that many of these children already suffer in households, and those that were suffering get worse. But those that were fine, as Ben is saying, actually, if the families are around them and can continue to give them the care and support that they need, then the child is quite resilient and the family is able to get through it. In terms of your question, Belinda, what are the types of support that are provided? It's really a continuum. So there's 4 levels of a pyramid. So the first one is providing basic services and security to children. Access to information, it's the very first thing. As we all know, when you don't have information, you can get very anxious. When you get the information, just services, where are the services? Where can I get the food? Where's the shelter? What time can my child go to a makeshift school? That is already a huge support. Then the second level is community and family support. So supporting parents and caregivers, their mental health, supporting the community to acknowledge what they're going through. Then there's the focused non-specialized support, which is the 3rd level of the pyramid. And here we're already looking at children that are suffering from post-traumatic stress or from depression or from bedwetting, internalizing behavior, externalizing behavior. And then the top level of the pyramid is the specialized services. And those are often children that already had severe mental health issues like psychosis or depression or anxiety, and those need very much additional support, often by psychiatrists. So those are the 4 levels of the pyramid that we look into.
Ben, you want to come in?
Yeah, 2 points. Firstly, just to add to that, I think that a lot of the ethos of what we try and do for children in terms of mental health in a crisis response is try to get a resumption of what we call normal childhood activities, the right to play, support and space for parents and for parenting, and to try and get kids back to school as quickly as possible. We saw during COVID the impact on the mental health of children to be locked away, and that's something the whole world can understand. Sorry, not to be locked away, to have lockdown and to have to stay at home. And the second thing that I want to just highlight, because Sabine kind of made me think about it, is that there's a political incentive for this as well, because all of the evidence shows us that when children are exposed to trauma, to toxic stress, when they grow up in contexts where they don't feel safe, they're much more likely to become perpetrators or victims of violence themselves. So often cycles of conflict and intergenerational trauma are exacerbated by our failure to respond in the moment to the risk of trauma for the child. And this is really important in peace building and something that is not given enough attention.
So it's a huge problem, and it has a sort of a legacy far beyond the immediate situation. It's a generational impact, actually. Jamie?
Yeah, not only that, it's also a huge economic impact. The economic impact of violence against children or delayed development because of mental health issues is immense, and particularly for areas in the world where there is very low resources. And so the impact and the economic burden of violence against children or experiencing children growing up in conflict zones is immense. And so you can think of this now, we're building these layers of why is it important for interventions for support children's mental health in crisis context. You have the child rights perspective, you have the child well-being and health aspects, you have the long-term cycles of violence, and you have the economic burden. And so it's really, there's an immense kind of case been made for the need for effective, low-cost and scalable interventions that can support children in crisis zones.
Absolutely. Issan, you wanted to come in?
Yeah, and just to add to what Sabine, Ben and Jamie have already said, I wanted to mention that as much as we want to support children and adolescents, obviously the only way we can do this is through parents. And there's evidence that parents and caregivers could serve as the primary source of mental health and psychosocial support for children and adolescents through positive parenting. And that just brings me to what we have been doing the past few years through the different responses that we have had, you know, the COVID-19 response, and in the past 2 years, the Ukraine parenting response, Pakistan parenting response, as well as the responses that we've had in Syria, Turkey, and Sudan this year. So what we have been doing is providing support for parents, helping them to cope, and so that they can also support their children and adolescents to cope through the different crises.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, because that links very nicely onto, you know, what's the evidence base? What do we know about what works in this situation to actually improve mental health outcomes? I don't know, Stephanie, did you want to come in with some thoughts on that?
Definitely. I mean, there is a lot of evidence to show that family and home environments can act as protective factors for child development. In context of high violence, nurturing home environments can provide a buffer against the impact of these environmental factors. And so parenting interventions can really play a significant role in improving child outcomes and also caregiver outcomes. As you can imagine, in these settings, child behavior can change quite drastically. I mean, these situations must be very frightening. But caregivers have a sort of compromised capacity to deal with that. You're thinking about, you know, they're exposed to financial stress. They're also exposed to traumatic events. And then uncertainty, even after the immediate aftermath of a crisis, you may have to resettle and move and deal with sort of acculturation stressors. So interventions that really work to address these and help caregivers with sort of evidence-based key strategies on how to work with their children, to talk about difficult emotions and to really communicate, like spending one-on-one time with your children. These are sort of key principles that seem to run through a lot of parenting interventions.
Thank you. I mean, I'm just thinking, how do you even do that though? I mean, when you're in these crisis situations where really, you know, people are fearing for their lives and everything is in turmoil and even communications must be really challenging. How do you deliver a parenting intervention? If that's not such a daft question, Stephanie.
I think that's a really interesting question and something we've had to grapple with a lot in the last few years. I mean, in response specifically to COVID, we've had to do a lot of thinking around, okay, how do we become quite innovative in the way we deliver these programs? Do we move online? You have to address sort of digital gaps in who has access to technology, but that was one way that we could still provide these resources to caregivers when a lot of in-person programming just had to stop. I work in a team of intervention developers on the Parenting for Lifelong Health program, And that saw some rapid adaptations that I was very excited to be involved in. One was titled Parent Chat, and we had to adapt an in-person program for delivery via WhatsApp, which, you know, we hadn't done before, but parents were able to join in a WhatsApp group. You had dedicated time in which you were supposed to be in the group, but you could access these resources at any point in the day. So maybe you're working from home and your child is sort of is around, they're also being homeschooled and you're really struggling with how to access any sort of information. You could just go to your phone and talk to other parents and really get that sort of network of support. So I think it's driven innovation in delivery of parenting programs forward in a way.
Yes, thank you. Sabine, you wanted to come in.
Yeah, and just 3 points on the evidence. Firstly, there is a lot of evidence for parent and caregiver support, as Stephanie was saying, in terms of how effective it is, even in humanitarian settings. WHO just did a full-on systematic review, in fact, with Oxford University, and it shows that at least 19 projects have been implemented, parenting and caregiver support projects have been implemented in humanitarian settings, both conflict and natural disasters, and have shown impact. So that's the first point, really important to note that parent and caregiver support works in humanitarian settings. The second point is just stepping away from parent and caregiver support. There are actually quite a lot of evidence-based interventions for children's mental health, and those include cognitive behavior therapy, play therapy, family therapy, school-based interventions. And sometimes we have a tendency to forget that children are children, and whether they're in Switzerland or in London or in Bangladesh or in Bogota, their minds function the same way, and they might be more stressed in a conflict or in a natural disaster, but they may also be stressed after a day of school or have had a troubling situation at home. So those interventions that work in high income countries can be used and adapted for natural disasters or conflict areas. And then my last point is about evidence generally. I think the aid world is often very strict, and I think we need to develop a work culture where we're much more thinking about knowledge and sharing and be less strict in terms of what we have to achieve by when. And I think we are getting that in organizations like Parenting for Lifelong Health from Oxford University are very good at understanding that they quickly need to adapt in order to bring their projects to scale. And so they share, they learn, and then they adapt their programs. So those are important points around the evidence.
All really important points. So there's a sort of something about evidence being good enough to be being rolled out rather than waiting for maybe sort of gold standard level of clinical trial evidence. Jamie.
I do think there is something that we should say that kind of gives a proviso around that evidence. And so a lot of that evidence is mostly based on randomized controlled trials of rigorously tested interventions, a lot of them delivered by incredible organizations like IRC, International Rescue Committee, and others who have done incredible work on testing their interventions. But these are families where, by and large, they've been settled already in a refugee camp. We're not talking about what's the evidence for providing family support and supporting the mental health of families in crisis at the moment of the crisis itself, whether that is a crisis because of conflict or climate disaster. And there we still have a lot of work to do. And some of the work that we have been doing around the Ukraine crisis is trying to find ways to evaluate how can we support families with mental health support, with parenting support, at the moment of the crisis situation, where it's harder to do. You can't really do a randomized control trial and say, okay, you guys get it, but you guys don't get it. So we have to be more innovative in looking at how we can test the efficacy of those programs. And sometimes we have to do the best we can with the circumstances while providing support at the same time.
Absolutely. Ben, you wanted to follow up.
I think there's something very revolutionary happening here that I think it's important to pick up. So if we go all the way back to attachment research with Bowlby and Ainsworth, one of the key findings was that the parents are less likely to transmit intergenerational trauma, neglect, violence, if they are aware and conscious of parenting and of their own child experience and how that can affect parenting. We then have all of the research on toxic stress and adverse childhood experiences and the way that when the brain is when the stress response system is chronically activated because children feel unsafe or unloved, that derails child development. But strong relationships are the buffer against toxic stress. And now we have the research that Sabine referred to, which is the implementation science that shows this idea of parents being aware and strategic about parenting and preventing trauma and preventing mental harm to their children, taking that to scale almost like a vaccine, making it available in the same way that a vaccine or another universal public health good is distributed in humanitarian contexts and in non-humanitarian contexts. And I think that gives us the idea that perhaps potentially we can eradicate or at least dramatically reduce child trauma in all contexts, the way we've reduced polio, for example.
Wow, I love that idea. A parenting intervention as a vaccine against poor mental health in the future. That's so powerful, isn't it? Issam, you wanted to speak.
Yes, and I really agree with everything that has been said so far. I just wanted to respond to your last question about delivery in humanitarian settings. So building on from what Stephanie said, one of the things I think, first of all, it's important to mention that all the parenting responses that we have carried out have been collaborations with UN agencies, international organizations, and other partners. And one of the first things that we do when we are about to launch a response anyway is to look for, identify partner organizations, local NGOs that we can partner with in the adaptation of the resources that we have, which are all evidence-based. Sabine, Jamie, and Ben have already spoken about the evidence. So we work with the local partners to adapt the resources and then work with them, support them to deliver this. So we don't actually go there to the different settings, but through the local NGOs and partner organizations, the translations are done and then the resources are delivered.
Yeah, do you want to tell us a bit more about that? I know you've been working with partners in Nigeria. What are the challenges of trying to deliver actual real life implementation of these programs?
Oh, we have met with a number of challenges. And I think the first thing is the evidence and research in humanitarian settings is quite limited. So we haven't had a lot of RCTs there. So we need more evidence on what interventions work best and in the different settings. You know, when we talk about humanitarian settings, they're all different. Like COVID is so different from the flood situation in Pakistan or the climate crisis in Syria and Turkey or the conflict in Ukraine. So you have different settings and we really actually need more evidence on that. And then another challenge we have had is that I've just talked about working or partnering with different local organizations. They are limited in capacity and in resources. And some of the challenges we've had is limited funding as well. So when there is a crisis, funders and people who want to support bodies, funding bodies, I think the first thing, the needs that they prioritize are things like shelter, food and clothing. And this is not to say that these are not a priority, but the case is that mental health should also be a priority. So you don't find that there is so much support for that in crisis because people don't really think about the mental health support of the people who are affected by crisis. So for that reason, we have limited funding. And then many of the local organizations that would really want to partner are limited in terms of human resources and other resources. So that's another challenge.
A major challenge, yes.
Sure. And then just to say that we are currently working on an evaluation of the Ukraine parenting response and the response that we have carried out in Pakistan. And we hope that with that, we'll add to the evidence that already exists.
Yeah, thank you. Sabine?
I'd like to add to Issam. I have three challenges that have come to my mind over the years repeatedly in every emergency. The first one is time. You wish that you had time to do a proper ethnographic review of what the values are, the morals, the partners on the ground, and take time to assess that and then think of the implementation. So that's the first one. The second one is innovation. Ideally, you have managers that are pushing for innovation. Often agencies are afraid, so they copy paste interventions. Whereas again, PLH is a good example that is ready to innovate between Ukraine, between Pakistan, and we need to dare to innovate, to make mistakes, to learn, to improve. And the third one is evaluations. Often we don't have the funding to put money into evaluations, so we just do something and then after 6 months, we don't bother to evaluate. So doing the proper analysis, being able to innovate and having evaluations in place are three core components. I also just want to add that there are two very strong groups working on mental health. That's the Interagency Standing Committee on Mental Health and Psychosocial Support that's been running for over 15 years. And in every emergency, they are there. They're coordinating the response and trying to do what I've been saying, the assessment, the innovation and the evaluations. And the other one is a much more bottom-up community of practice called the MHPSS, Mental Health and Psychosocial Support Network, who ask frontline practitioners from the ground in the emergencies to upload resources to a web platform. So those are two groups that are very active in the mental health space.
It's all absolutely crucial, isn't it? Because of course, the assumption is that everything we do is going to be helpful, but that's absolutely not the case, is it? I mean, history has shown that actually some psychological interventions after crises are positively unhelpful, aren't they? I'm thinking of debriefing after traumatic events, for instance. Jamie, do you want to come in?
Yeah, one of the things we're really excited about is the collaboration that we have with the university, between the University of Oxford and UNICEF, World Health Organization, Global Partnership to End Violence Against Children, and the Early Childhood Development Action Network called, and this collaboration is coming under the formation of a new consortium or partnership called the Global Initiative to Support Parents. And the key component of that partnership and that initiative that we at the University of Oxford are serving is really building that evidence of what works best and where and how and for whom. And a large component of that is around parents of crisis. It's really grown out of the work that we did in co-leading the COVID-19 Playful Parenting Emergency Response that Isang and Stephanie and others have talked about. And this initiative that is co-led by other colleagues around the world at other universities, especially in six specific countries. So in Thailand, Philippines, Malaysia, Uganda, Tanzania, and South Africa under the Global Parenting Initiative, has been focusing on how do we design and optimize and test these innovations, these programs to support the mental health and well-being of families, and particularly in crisis situations. And one of the ones that I'm especially excited about is one that Stephanie is working on very closely along the border of Thailand and Myanmar around supporting families there. And I was just wondering maybe if Stephanie wants to share more about this, because it is really a crisis situation that is quite acute, and it took some innovative ways of working with the community to develop the interventions, but then also how to test them so that we're building the robust evidence of how they work.
Absolutely. So I'm working on a very exciting multi-year project. And as Jamie mentioned, the context that I'm working in, it is a crisis setting, but it's very much a sort of protracted crisis. This region has seen a lot of migration in response to sort of eruptions of violence that have been happening across the border in Myanmar. So it is a population where some people have been there for a really long time under sort of quite challenging circumstances. And then also there's an influx of people entering the region at the moment. And as part of this, we thought, you know, it's really important to talk to people who have been working in this area for a long time. So we've been collaborating with community-based organizations. We've got sort of partnering with local NGOs and several academic partners. And we've found it to be really key to put community voices at the heart of the intervention design process. And the way that we've decided to sort of address the needs of the community as they came out through interviews was to take a multi-stage approach. So the first one addresses this sort of more light touch intervention that's been mentioned in the pyramid. So it's something that we're going to show to many caregivers in the area. And it's quite innovative. We have decided to develop a film that promotes positive parenting. And again, very community driven. I had the pleasure of working very closely with our director, who is from the community, and who developed the script with input regarding specific evidence-based sort of parenting practices that we want to be sort of shown in the film. And this will be screened across the region, and we will be evaluating it in a cluster randomized control trial. So really contributing to this evidence base of, you know, how effective are these light touch interventions that do have significant capacity for scale up. And then in terms of the slightly more intensive needs of other caregivers, we are working again with local NGOs to develop a caregiver focused intervention. And what this actually looks like is going to depend a lot from the sort of upcoming work that we're doing, where we're bringing all service providers in the region who work across child protection and mental health to really understand what's happening at the moment. People have identified that there's quite a sort of fractured service provision landscape. So how do we work with everyone to provide a service that's not going to overburden people who are trying to help community members, and how that it can be a sustainable part of their programming beyond when this project finishes? And I think that's another really important part of the work that a lot of us are focusing on, is how do we make them, how do we make interventions and programs sustainable and scalable?
Absolutely. Oh, thank you for telling us about that. It sounds absolutely fascinating work.
Hello, I hope you're enjoying this episode of Future Makers Brain and Mental Health. If you'd like to learn more about our work here in Oxford, head to ox.ac.uk/brain, or let us know what you think on social media using the hashtag OxfordBrain.
I was really struck, Jamie, you're saying the key is to work out what works for whom. I mean, that's, you know, true of everything we do, isn't it, in research. But I'm wondering, Sabine, you know, at your level, how do you decide what interventions to put in place? Does it depend on the nature of the conflict situation, for instance, or the crisis situation? Does it depend on the region of the world you're dealing with? How sort of tailored are the responses that you look to deliver?
Thank you. That's a really good question. I just also want to take a step back on the link between child protection and mental health, if that's okay, because there's such a strong correlation there. I think it's really important to note that often individuals that have mental health issues, be they depressions or psychosis or substance abuse, alcohol abuse, or a history of trauma, can be more violent and therefore either put themselves at risk of violence if they're young people, or put others at risk of violence, or put their children at risk of violence. And then the converse is true as well. So children that have suffered violence will, according to a lot of evidence, demonstrate short and long-term psychological damage resulting from the violence. And so maybe some children will not show clinical levels of concern, but other survivors will show depression, anxiety, substance abuse, even cognitive impairments. And then some children will actually meet the full criteria of psychiatric illnesses. So it's important to make that link and see how much violence there is in, just to answer your question, Belinda, to understand the violence that's happening, not just in the community, but also within the homes. And then to address that through parent and caregiver support programs, for example, or through school-based interventions, and then assess which children need which type of support. Do you have a high number of children that have psychiatric illnesses, in which case you need probably medicine, psychologists, psychiatrists, or is it actually a majority of children? I'm trying to think of an example. For example, in Peru, when I was there after the earthquake, they're a very religious community also where the earthquake happened. And in fact, they were doing okay. They very quickly came together around their religious communities and were able to support each other. The government response was quite solid, and they were able to step up quite quickly. So it really depends not on the nature, if it's a conflict or a natural disaster, but more around which systems were in place before, how you can rely on those systems. And I'm talking about community systems and government systems, and then how you can build on those and then build back better where possible.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So that's such an important point, isn't it, Ben?
Can I just riff off that and say that there's a brilliant definition of child trauma. Trauma is the disruption of connection. Connection is the most important protective factor in the lives of children, the sense that they belong, that they feel loved and are safe where they live. The danger for children is not just the presence of violence, it's also the absence of love. So when what Sabine's referring to there is the religious community is local resilience. It's a community that has a sense of connection and belonging that it can quickly recover that connection within the community and support families to recover. And I think part of the long-term effort to insulate all societies against child trauma in conflict and non-conflict is to build those resilience characteristics in all of our communities, not just parenting, but also ensuring that schools, communities, religious organizations are able to respond to child trauma before it's too late.
Thank you. You both made the point very eloquently, and it's such an important one. I want to come on and ask each of you what your hopes for the future working in this field are. Where do you see either the research or the implementation side? You know, what are you hopeful about for the future? Who shall I start with? Ben, shall I start with you?
Yeah, I'd like four things to happen. I'd like us to recognise that we don't spend enough on child mental health in all contexts, including humanitarian. Jamie alluded to the costs. 7% of GDP globally, a very conservative estimate, are the costs of not addressing or preventing child trauma in all settings. So for governments to invest in prevention and response. The second one is to have a conversation in every community. Mental health, violence against children, all of those issues remain taboo and often characterized by myth in most parts of the world. But now we have the ability to address that and ensure there's a conversation in every community. The third thing to do is to make sure that parenting programs are universal, because the evidence from over 270 randomized controlled trials in the WHO systematic review show that they have huge impact. And fourthly, to make sure that every school and every community is trauma-informed and able to respond to child mental health. So investment, a conversation in every community, universal parenting programs, and all schools to be trauma-informed or trauma-aware.
Wonderful. Sabine, what are your hopes for the future?
Of course, very similar to Ben's. Maybe I just want to add one to his four, is the voices of children and the voices of parents. We often, the children that are suffering most, whether they're children with disabilities or children suffering from violence in their household or children living on the streets, they are suffering day and night. They're afraid, they're hungry, they have no vision of their future. And yet we don't hear them. We don't give them a space to speak up. And we talk about other issues that are important to adults. And so having a voice for children, for me, is so essential. And the other thing is having a voice for parents. Anyone that is a parent or who has a parent, which is every single one of us, knows how tough the relationship with parents can be and how difficult parenting can be. And I think, as Ben said, breaking the taboo on that. So breaking the taboo about mental health, but also breaking the taboo about the difficulties around parenting, not just early childhood, but middle childhood, adolescence as well. And I think giving voices to those who we're working with and for is absolutely essential for children and parents.
And it's wonderful to see the WHO really, you know, active in this area and really promoting mental health. I mean, you know, I've been around a long time. I may look young, but I'm not. but it really is relatively new that actually this mental health for all, that mental health, is actually now a sort of an accepted kind of mantra. So thank you, I guess. Jamie.
Exactly, Belinda. And building on that, it's one of my the things that gets me excited and hopeful for the future is to see how these large institutions and governments and players have coalesced around the issue of supporting families to provide the best support for mental health and well-being and for children and for their caregivers. And that hadn't happened very often, happened around other kind of diseases or other kind of contexts, but not around mental health and not around violence prevention until really recently. And so that makes me very hopeful that we can get over some of the silos that we operate in and see how, you know, even in this podcast, we have people from academia and people from UN agencies and people who come from implementation and media backgrounds all coming together talking about mental health issues. So that's one thing that really gives me hope, is that people are seeing this as the supporting families in crisis context is a crisis of itself, and we need to coalesce around that. But more than that, I really am hopeful for our ability to shift away from a reaction to crisis. We were very reactive to the COVID-19 pandemic or to the war in Ukraine or the floods in Pakistan or all the climate issues that are happening right now. And I'd love to see I see there being the potential to shift from there to a place of being building preparedness and resilience for communities and families, and an ability to both avoid those mental health impacts, but also to be able to respond and not react to those. And I think that one of the things that, I mean, it's kind of like there and it's all around us, is the ability to, or the potential to harness what technology can offer to help us build those solutions. Even AI-driven solutions could be a game changer in our capacity to address mental health issues, even if they're simple things of supporting parents or those who support parents and families. And that all builds to my large kind of big picture hope, is that, you know, we have the Parenting for Lifelong Health and the Global Initiative to Support Parents in Oxford, where that vision of that every parent everywhere has access to effective, freely available, relatable support that is for every parent everywhere. And really, especially those in crisis contexts, and for those who get ignored, those living with disabilities, those who are on the fringes of the support, those who maybe we see that they were from crisis contexts, but now they're refugees and migrants in Europe, and they're even ignored or put on barges in our own country. And where is the support that we need to provide to support for those too? So really going beyond the barriers of access and support that we normally see.
I love the vision, Jamie, absolutely. And this idea of a sort of mental health preparedness plan for crisis. And I don't know if anybody's actually doing that, are they? I mean, we had a lot of pandemic preparedness, but I don't think anyone's considering the mental health aspects of preparedness.
I think they are, actually, Belinda, because it's a lot about mental health care is a lot about people, supporting people. So there are around the world hundreds, thousands of people being trained on psychological first aid, whether they're water sanitation people or shelter people or nutrition people. So that's definitely one area in which we're being better prepared. Another one is assessments. So understanding the Haitian culture so that when there's the next earthquake in Haiti, you're ready to intervene, saying the right thing to the right religious groups in the right way. Another thing is, I know they, for example, work a lot on birth registration and sharing information and knowing where children have to go when there's an issue, to which hospital and how. So there are preparedness plans that continuously get put up, especially in the countries that are most affected by natural disasters and wars.
And you can even go further than that and look at like how we can build the preparedness of the family, building the competencies of families to be able to have that resilience within themselves, whether that's helping them learn simple ways of supporting their mental health, being able to deal with stress, even in non-crisis situations that can be applicable to when they become under acute crisis. Also, the ability to have positive and supportive relationships with your child. Those things that builds the resilience in the family to be able to withstand some of those shocks. And I think that's something that when Ben and colleagues talk about universal provision of evidence-based parenting support, those things build the resilience in those families so that they can thrive in the face of crisis.
Wonderful. Issam, do you want to talk about your hopes for the future?
Yes. So thanks, Belinda. First of all, I think Sabine, Jamie and Ben have already said a lot of what I would have liked to say. But the first thing that struck me is that you know, we're having this conversation here, but, and it feels so normal, so natural for us to be talking about this. But in my home country, like in most places in Africa, talking about mental health issues, there's so much stigma around that. So first of all, I hope that we can get to a point where there isn't a lot of stigma, or there is no stigma really, that should be the case. And where it feels so normal, you know, as I listened to us talk about this, I thought, wow, you know, I wish that this could happen in Nigeria, in other places. So I would hope that my hope for the future includes getting to a point that this is not, mental health is not a taboo subject in Nigeria, in Africa, and in developing countries. And I hope that is something that, you know, not just, we would not just normalize the conversation, but we would go on to be able to provide support to everyone who needs it, that it will become, you know, just like you access healthcare services, everybody will be freely able to access mental health support. So that includes part of what I really, really hope for the future. And then personally, I'm really hoping one thing I'd really desire and hope that I can do in the next few years is to continue to carry on research with victims or with people who have been affected by humanitarian crisis. And particularly, I'm looking and I'm very keen on working with victims of Boko Haram in Nigeria.
Wow, thank you, Isang, and good luck to you. That sounds such important work. Stephanie, what are your hopes for the future?
I think building on what everyone has said before, I think they're great points. I think also just really centering community voices in the work that we do. And part of this is, you know, Isang alluded, talked about this before, around the stigma around talking about mental health. But I've also seen in a lot of my work, although there's stigma around talking about mental health explicitly, there are some sort of natural and existing practices that support people's mental health. There are things that people engage in. Maybe they don't talk about it in terms of mental health, but it will be sort of what they'll, if you ask about what people are doing when they're stressed, they'll allude to some practices they already engage in. So I think sort of building that into interventions that we're developing at the moment and sort of strengthening that maybe with the evidence-based moving forward, I think that's something I'm quite excited about. And again, on my previous point about sustainable interventions, things that can be built into existing systems, and this goes to the preparedness point that Jamie raised. I think if you have culturally acceptable interventions that have been developed with communities and are already integrated into like healthcare settings that can be provided by community health workers, for example, I think that's a really exciting avenue for the future and something I hope to see more of.
Thank you, Stephanie. You're all very good communicators. It's really powerful, actually. God, I mean, I was sort of, it's like that. Thank God.
It is our job day and night. It's our bread and butter since many years. So if we're not good at it, then we'd be worrying.
There's also an interesting thing that when you look at the stuff that human rights and development organizations and others do, a lot of it, the argument has already been won. So vaccines, nutrition, like I oversee advocacy in different areas sometimes. And it, you know, the argument's already been won. You're just going out trying to get policymakers to live up to their commitments. With mental health, prevention of child maltreatment, all of that, the argument's not yet been won. Yeah. This should be a global norm. So we have to be good communicators because we've got to go out and convince presidents and prime ministers and other religious leaders to make this happen. And so that's why it's great that all the people on the call are such fantastic communicators because it's a revolutionary idea and we hope it becomes normal within the next few years.
It's such a key point, isn't it? I feel as though I spent 30 years shouting into the wind, basically, about the vital importance of mental illness and severe mental illness and what an absolute criminal shame in it, you know, lost opportunities and lost lives that this isn't treated properly or researched properly, you know. So, but it does feel as though... you know, there is a growing awareness, isn't there? I mean, we're hopeful.
It's a historical process, right? If you read the Steven Pinker wrote this brilliant book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, about how violence very slowly is reducing over time. And he reminds us that until a few centuries ago, infanticide was very common in every country in the world. anything related to mental health was being seen as being possessed by the devil. It's only in the Enlightenment when people began to float the idea that maybe if you stop beating kids, they might actually become happier, healthier people. And gradually, you know, even in the early 20s in the United States, early 1920s in the United States, people from Johns Hopkins University, Department of Psychology, were advising people not to kiss and hug their children because it would spoil them, right? So this is a historical process, and we're part of that, and we're trying to accelerate it in the same way that people just a generation ago accelerated our understanding of vaccines. We're lucky to live at a time when we have all this brain science that strengthens the arguments that we've had from psychology and psychiatry and gives us something that is more compelling for hard-nosed policymakers.
Well, I was going to ask you, maybe that is a question. You know, how do you get policymakers to really respond and really listen? What's the voice that they really listen to, I guess?
There are multiple angles that we have now. I think Jamie and Sabine and Isank alluded to them. You know, there's the economic argument. We know that the primary preventable cause of poor mental health, addiction, probably crime, and a whole range of other things are adverse childhood experiences, and that they're preventable, right? So if you want to prevent terrorism, violence, all of the addiction, poor mental health, all of the things that cost that 7% of GDP, you can, right? There are ways to do it, but we just have to create political conditions. I think that's the first thing. The second thing is that often, as an advocate, I would go to see very conservative religious leaders or others, because often the liberals are sometimes easier to persuade because they take the human rights approach. But for others, I mean, showing the brain science, I've been to see leaders and taken brain scans of what happens to children in situations of toxic stress. And those kind of bringing the science, the economics, the human rights, making it across constituency issue is really important. There are many competing priorities in it, you know, so you have to get the arguments right.
If I just can add one thing, I love how Ben always makes a seamless link between the mental health issues, violence against children, and parenting support. So I think it's so essential because that's the link that people need to start understanding. I do think in the past 25 years, we've made enormous progress on mental health. I mean, WHO has the Mental Health Gap Program. UNICEF has this program called Mind the Gap. And so it's a lot about mental health, but it focuses quite a lot on adults and on the more serious psychiatry. But I think what Ben is also alluding to is this link is still not clear between the adverse childhood experience, the mental health outcomes, and how we can then support that. And I think in addition to Ben's ideas about having to show the numbers, unfortunately, and having to show the science, I think showing the solutions is a third way forward, because the more parenting is a solution, school-based interventions are a solution, and that is a little bit more hopeful. So sometimes you kind of have to hit them with all three, with the evidence of the problem, the data on the science, and then the solutions to bring them along with you.
And there's one other thing. So can I just riff off that? Is the prevalence, right? People don't get the prevalence. People think that child protection, mental health, 2-3% of the child population, all of the 40 or so adverse childhood experiences surveys show that more than half of any given child population are experiencing some kind of serious risk factor for trauma, some form of childhood adversity. And and people that have not experienced that love somebody that has, or know somebody that has, or related to somebody that has. So this is not a marginal issue. It's not a them issue. It's an us issue. It's an everybody issue. And that's why we need universal primary prevention and response.
Yeah, I think another issue that we have is we can show make a very strong case for the need for mental health interventions and parenting support interventions. But when we're working with policymakers, they need the how as well. So it's not just that there is a way to do this, but how do you actually provide that to the people that need it most? And how do you do that within constrained budgets? And this is where we're really excited in our department and our collaboration with our partners around driving innovation around how do you design interventions that are scalable from the point of design, that have the buy-in of the communities and the implementers and policymakers. And so we're working on mental health and violence prevention intervention with the government in Malaysia. And we're involving the Malaysian government in the design process so that they also can, they're buying into it, but also that the solutions that we're coming up with, we're not going to do a randomized control trial of an intervention that cannot be scaled. It's just, we can't waste the money and the time that we've been doing in the past where we designed these incredible interventions, but they're just too clunky or intensive to be delivered to millions of families. And so this, like, being able to provide solutions that are realistic is really an essential part of that. And policymakers really, they respond positively to that question, because that's where they're under the crunch. A lot of the ones that we're talking to, whether it's in the Department of Social Welfare or it's in the Department of Health or Public Health Promotion in Sri Lanka, or if it's in the Educational Department, they get the need in a lot of respects. Maybe not the top decision makers that Ben talks to when, you know, they're having to make those really critical decisions on like green lighting this, but the people who are in the doing aspect of policy. But they don't have the solutions that can be scaled that are effective. And I think that's where we're driving the future of our research, of our innovation, and of our delivery and advocacy.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Future Makers Brain and Mental Health. You can find more episodes of Future Makers wherever you get your podcasts, and more on Oxford's research at ox.ac.uk/brain. Thanks for listening.